Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. On Sacramento Street in San Francisco sits a big old boxy brown brick building known as Cameron House. Its history goes back to 1874 when it became a rescue house for girls and women who were escaping slavery and the sex trade in the city. Most of these girls and women were Chinese. Historian and journalist Julia Flynn Seiler traces this history from the mid-1870s in a book that was an editor's choice by the New York Times Book Review. It's titled The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. And Julia has come from San Francisco to join us in the studio. Welcome. I'm so glad to have you here.
Thank you, Beth. I'm so happy to be here.
This book is rich with stories, so let's start with one.
Of course. So imagine December 14th, 1933 in San Francisco's Chinatown. Chickens are squawking in cages. There's laundry dangling from the sidewalk. There's the scent of sizzling wok oil. And there's a teenager who has been captured, and she's in a beauty shop and left alone for a few minutes, and she makes a decision to run for it. She has been forced into prostitution, and this is her one opportunity to make the dash a few blocks to a safe house being run at that time by a group of women. And it's the dusk is settling, it's getting dark, and she makes the run for freedom. And as a result, this teenager, her name was Zhong Guoying, she ends up testifying in probably the most important sex trafficking case in San Francisco and in the West at that time, and bringing her captors to justice.
Let's go back to the discovery of gold, because you will revisit that story later in the book. But if we start in 1848, 20,000 Chinese men plus came to California. And at first, only a few women, correct?
Correct. The Chinese men were looking for opportunities, economic opportunities, and they often left their families at home. And so that led to the term bachelor society, where many of the men were in California, but the women were not.
You write very specifically about the demand for sex being pent up by what was a glaring gender imbalance. So over the next 10 years, what happened and what was happening as ships full of women and girls came in, not to mention the stories they were being told that prompted them to take the journey in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Well, the gold rush ended. And, of course, the project of the Transcontinental Railroad, which Chinese workers were so fundamentally important to, that ended as well in the 1860s. And many Chinese men came back to the big city, which was San Francisco, where there was the largest community of Chinese Americans in North America. And there was, as you note, Beth, a very striking gender discrepancy. There were, at one point in the 19th century, 22 men for every single Chinese woman. And that led to a demand for women to serve as prostitutes, and many of them were forced into this, kidnapped or tricked by some ruse to come to the United States.
And by the way, at this time, prostitution was not illegal.
That's
in the
right.
City or in the state.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was not illegal. However, the trafficking of humans and all of the things that surrounded that, the crime that surrounded that, was illegal. And likewise, the trafficking was handled by criminal tong organizations, which realized there was a great profit to be made in bringing women to supply this need for sex.
So the founders of Cameron House, and we can say more about what that house became, were, I'll use your description from the book, Victorian-era churchwomen with their bustles, corsets, and elaborate piles of hair. They were people who were, again from your book, driven by compassion toward these enslaved women. How did you find the records and stories of their earliest work?
Yes. These women were mostly middle-class women, and they were church women. And one of the struggles that that many historians have in documenting trafficking and documenting the lives of women who had very few records around is that they didn't leave very much evidence behind of their experiences. There were very few letters. There were very few diaries. However, this house had a continual record from the 1870s, when it was founded, to the 1930s, when it was running as a safe house for women. And there are thousands of case records of every single girl and woman who passed through it, and an occasional boy as well. That is an extraordinary historical record, and it had been closed off to historians for years to protect the privacy of the families of the women who came through the home. But in working with the archivist of the home, who is a Chinese-American woman named Doreen Durr McLeod, she came to trust that I would tell these stories with care and respect, and shared not every single case file, but a number of them with me and opened them up to me.
Is this the record, by the way, that you write that during the earthquake, as the earthquake was happen, Donaldina Cameron, who Cameron House is named for, ended up running back and talking her way past guards to be able to retrieve?
Yes, that you put your finger on it. I mean, one of the great challenges for historians, particularly historians writing about San Francisco, is the 1906 earthquake destroyed so many records. Chinatown itself was razed by fire, and so many records disappeared at that moment. One exception was the handwritten logbook that the women who ran the home kept, dating back to 1870. And yes, the superintendent of the home at the time of the 1906 earthquake, whose name was Donaldina Cameron, she was known as Dolly, very courageously went back in the middle of the night to go back and retrieve that logbook. And save it for posterity and for researchers and historians such as myself.
Dolly Cameron is one name. Margaret Culbertson is another. And with this, I think we should go to the phrase that's in the title of the book, The White Devils, The White Devil. Mm-hmm. Would you explain what that phrase meant and who these women became really in the iconic history of San Francisco?
Sure. So these were middle-class women, as I mentioned, mostly, who were disrupting the very lucrative business of human trafficking in San Francisco in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And this was a business that was profitable to both white officials and to criminal Tong members, Chinese criminal Tong members. And the Tong members who controlled the traffic would try to warn off women and girls from seeking refuge in the home by telling stories, by saying, don't go there, the white devil will poison you. Don't go there, the white devil drinks blood. And when they're using that phrase, they were referring to the women running the home as white devils. Mm-hmm. And the title very specifically refers to one of those women, Donaldina Cameron, who became known as the white devil. And she was also very much appreciated and loved by a number of the residents of the home who came to refer to her as Lomo, or Old Mother. And she, in turn, referred to them as her daughters. And that's why the title of the book is The White Devil's Daughters.
The stories are remarkable. I'd like you to share another one. And I'll add that in the scope of time from mid-1870s to as late as the rescues continued, the estimate is that more than 1,000 women, girls, and as you said, the occasional boy were helped, not only Chinese, but vulnerable young people who needed the safe place and the security of being able to restart life.
Even more than that, Beth, if we look from the 1870s to the 1930s, our best estimate is between 2,000 and 3,000 girls and women took refuge, passed through the doors of the home. And some of those girls and women had babies there, and many of them ended up marrying out of the home. The home kind of became an informal marriage bureau for the Chinese American community. And so there's this incredible diaspora of Cameron House families across the country.
I'm talking with Julia Flynn Seiler. She is a New York Times bestselling author, previously a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and Business Week. You might know her previous books, which include Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, The Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure, and The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. I'm going to add that Julia will be at the Napa College Performing Arts Center on Thursday, February 6th. This is for an author's forum on this book and others. And I'm curious about how this came up on your radar. With so much digging to find the research and so many of these names being hidden away from kind of contemporary discussion, how did it pop up for you?
Sure. I was very interested in writing about my home state and about my home city of San Francisco. And I did face the issue of so many of the records disappearing after the 1906 earthquake. And I realized that this home was a place that had a continual historical record from the 1870s to the 1930s. And what's more, there were such vivid characters involved in this story, ranging from Captain Jack Mannion, who was the head of the Chinatown squad, to Dolly Cameron, the courageous daughter of a Scottish sheep farmer, to probably my favorite character, Tien Fu Wu, who was sold by her father to pay his gambling debts in China, worked in a brothel as a child servant, and came to become the key aide to Donalena Cameron for decades.
Miss Wu went back to China years later to try to find the family that she'd lost. Do you have any sense of how many other girls who were now women as they got older did this? And she wasn't successful. Were others able to ever find reunions to reunite?
Well, there was so much civil strife and so much chaos in those years of war and famine in China that I think Miss Wu's experience was probably typical of not being able to easily locate family members anymore. And we have to remember that Tien Fu Wu was an extraordinarily privileged position even to go back to China to look. She had been educated. She'd gone to college. She was traveling around the United States on the house's efforts to kind of track down trafficked women. She, you know, it's one of the most poignant moments of the book, I think, when she cannot find her family. It's a great sorrow. And her family, of course, became Donaldina Cameron and the other girls and women at the home.
Could we go back to the very first story that you told and use that as an example of what would happen to a young girl coming over, how she was prepped for the family she would know, what she was told to do immediately when she landed, when she got to California?
Well, the business model of trafficking has not changed very much in the last 150 years. A young girl would be approached by a procurer, somebody who would make promises that there would be a lucrative job waiting for her in San Francisco or elsewhere so that she could help her family financially, or make other promises. There may have been a promised husband waiting for her in the United States. And she gets to the United States after studying a coaching book, because after the 1882 Exclusion Act, only merchants' families and elite families from China were permitted to enter the United States. And so she would pretend, with the coaching of the traffickers, to be a member of this elite group. If she passed through immigration, she would then very quickly realize that, in fact, she was being forced into prostitution. There was no husband. There was no good job waiting for her. And the typical lifespan of a young girl or woman who had been tricked in that way might be 4 years because of diseases, because of drug addiction, or other terrible stresses involved in forced prostitution.
Hmm. What's the response been from Chinese readers?
I have gotten many, many thank yous for writing this story from Chinese readers. And one of the most kind of poignant things for me has been to hear from the descendants of some of the women who came through the home and to tell me that, you know, their mother had never told them the story, but there's her picture in the book or there's her story in the book. And that has been incredibly touching. And I've done a number of events at Cameron House itself involving the Chinese community. And of course, this was a partnership. I work with Doreen Dermacloud, who is the former superintendent of the home, to bring this story back to life. So I would say that the response has been a very thankful one.
The reviews, Julia, are amazing. Georgia Rowe in the Mercury News wrote, "It's an astonishing tale of devotion and heroism. It's the women themselves who fill the book's pages. Seiler's descriptions of the crowded Cameron House are indelible." And then this from Maura Elizabeth Cunningham in the Wall Street Journal. "Her smooth prose and vivid descriptions, as well as the numerous photographs reproduced throughout the book, create a compelling picture of life in the rough and tumble world of San Francisco's Chinatown. I will add that the pictures really make the stories vivid, and I found myself looking deeper into faces than I might ever have because I knew the backstory of whoever was in the photograph."
Thank you.
So there are patches of history here that are really painful. The Joy Zone, part of that 1915 Pan-Pacific exhibition that happened in San Francisco, and the underground slumming setback. There was the bubonic plague, the flu pandemic. Will you choose one of those to characterize how there was this movement to go forward and past this history, but culture and profiteering businessmen and corruption seem to keep yanking it back time and again?
Mm-hmm. Probably the top of mind story for me right now, Beth, is the story set right at the turn of the 20th century in Chinatown involving a bubonic plague and efforts by the city to seal off that roughly 8-square-block quarter from the rest of the city, believing that that would stop the plague. And of course, there was not an understanding then that the plague was carried by fleas on the rats. But that story to me is so resonant of what is going on right now in China with the efforts to contain it somehow, and the fear and also acts of courage that took place. I mean, the Chinatown quarter was running out of food, and there were a few courageous people who went over the lines, the quarantine lines, and delivered food to people in Chinatown to help them at that point.
So this ended up being most of Chinatown.
Yes.
That was quarantined. And you're comparing that with what we're seeing and hearing now with the coronavirus.
Yes,
in
that's
China.
Exactly right.
Again, another comparison, past to present. January happens, in fact, to be the National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month in the United States. And the fact that we've designated a month says a lot about how contemporary the battle is and how much it goes on, far beyond San Francisco, of course.
Absolutely. And one of the purposes of my writing this book was to raise awareness that the fight against human trafficking began in California 150 years ago, almost 150 years ago. And very few people are aware of these early anti-trafficking pioneers who were in San Francisco. And in fact, the testimony by some of the girls and women who had taken refuge in the Mission Home in front of state legislators who had come down from Sacramento to hear their stories led to one of the first pieces of anti-trafficking legislation in the state, if not in the country. So I think as Californians, we have a lot to feel proud about, and that we were fighting and aware of this issue early on.
The detailed writing about court cases is fascinating, and these court cases increasingly were covered by the media. So we have details in testimony and reaction. A Palo Alto case, for example, ended up really making Donaldina Cameron very famous and a very much revered figure. Julia Morgan becomes part of the story in designing a new home, a new era for the Cameron House. At the end of the book, there is some Sacramento intrigue that I want to ask you about. A young girl who alleged that she was raped by her school teacher, the DA perhaps not pursuing it, tongs related to Sacramento families perhaps. What do you know about this story?
Well, it's an extraordinary story. I learned about it from case files in Cameron House, which are still sitting, by the way, in a locked cupboard on the fifth floor of Cameron House, and very important families, two prominent families that were involved with tongs. These were not criminal tongs. These were tongs, which were organizations to support the Chinese community. And the Mission Home got involved with this young woman because she was pregnant and very vulnerable. She took refuge at the home. And in fact, Tian Fu Wu and Donaldina Cameron went before the Chinatown Peace Committee and tried to prevent violence between these two families. It's quite an extraordinary story. It happened in the first couple decades of the 20th century.
Are the Sacramento families named?
You know, we made the decision, Doreen, Durham McLeod, and I, not to name them because they're still very prominent families.
Mm. So this history goes far and wide. Are you still working on it? What's your next project?
Oh, thanks for asking, Beth. I'm fascinated by California history, by our state's incredible past. And so I'm looking again at an extraordinary life at the end of the 19th, early 20th century that has changed the face of California and involves a murder mystery, an unsolved murder mystery. That's all I'll say, though.
Mm. It's so great to have you in the studio. Thanks for coming the distance and being with us.
Thank you, Beth.
It's always a pleasure. And Julia Flynn Seiler is the author of The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. You can hear more from her and see her in person in Napa on February 6th. We posted a link with more information. You're going to hear some connection between the stories Julia just told and our next discussion, which is about a new exhibit at the California Museum. It also focuses on Chinese history in California. Again, Julia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.